Welcome to Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Racial profiling, police brutality, mass incarceration, all of these have become some of the most pressing issues plaguing the criminal justice system in our country. Let's talk some statistics. Today, there are more than 2.2 million people in prisons across the country. That compares to the pre-war on drugs era, say the 1970s, when the total prison population was only 200,000. And though the U.S. has just 5% of the world's population, it has 25% of the world's prisoners. About one in three are black men. More than 60% of the people in U.S. prisons are people of color. Nationally, black men are six times as likely to be incarcerated as white men. Today, there are more African Americans in prison, on probation, or on parole that were enslaved in all of 1850. Investigative stops, mandatory minimum sentences, so-called no-knock searches, all of these are some policies that have led to the mass incarceration of African Americans. These policies have certainly been criticized, and their impact has been well documented. But it's rarely focused on the fact that African American leaders have supported some of these policies. In his new book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America, today's guest, legal scholar James Foreman, tells the story of how African American leaders may have unwittingly fueled the mass incarceration of African Americans. He's drawing on his own experience as a public defender, and he offers some pretty important lessons to anyone who's concerned about the future of race and the criminal justice system. James Foreman Jr. is a law professor at Yale University, and he's a former public defender in Washington, D.C. And you may recognize the name. He's also the son of famous black civil rights leader James Foreman, who was a key organizer in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. James joins us in the studio. James Foreman Jr., what a pleasure.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's been remarkable. As I've read this book and shared it with friends and family, it has sparked so many conversations about this issue. So congratulations on a very timely book, but it's certainly a very thorny issue to be tackling head on. So why did you think it was important to talk about this issue?
Well, I felt as if, you know, I was somebody who came up understanding the civil rights and inequalities in the criminal justice system. You know, the history of racism, the history of white supremacy, the history of sort of not caring about black lives and being indifferent to black suffering. And that brought me to be a public defender. And then when I got to D.C., I saw something else as well, which is I was operating in a criminal justice system that had lots of African-American representation, whether it was police officers or judges or prosecutors to a lesser extent. And that system was grinding down my clients in the same way that it seemed to me that some of the systems I had studied in Louisiana and Oklahoma and Texas – I had done death penalty work, and I had seen some of those systems at work. And so I and my colleagues, we would often ask ourselves, you know, how is it that we're doing this to ourselves? You know, we would go into court with one of our clients, and this is mostly black lawyers in my office. It's a pretty integrated office, a lot of African-American lawyers, and our clients were overwhelmingly African-American. And we would have, you know, black judges give these incredible sentences, and we'd come back to the office, and we'd say, you know, we know why someone else is doing it, but why are we doing it to ourselves in that way? And the "we" here that I'm talking about is, you know, African American judges or prosecutors towards African American clients. And so that, I just wanted to explore that question. I really wanted to write a book about that phenomenon.
And yet, you knew at the time, because it was Washington, D.C. in the 70s, yes?
Yes.
That there was a problem with gangbanging, with gun violence, with open-air drug markets. People in these communities were desperate. They were asking for help, and this is what the help looked like. So why was that problematic, that people were asking for tougher sentences, longer sentences, more policing, more arrests, and that's what the community got?
So I guess when I say it's problematic, I'm starting with how I came to the work. So I came to the work because I viewed it as an extension of the original civil rights movement. You mentioned my dad, James Forman, and my mom, Constancia Romley. They were both in SNCC. They were an interracial couple, a black man, white woman, at a time when that was illegal in many states. And now I had the benefits of their movement that they had fought and won in many ways. And yet I looked at this phenomenon. We didn't have the word mass incarceration at the time, but we could see the disparities in the criminal justice system, the 1 in 3 young black men under criminal justice supervision number that you referenced. And so that brought me to be a public defender. So you have to understand where I was situated, right? I'm situated in a position where I'm fighting for people to keep them out of prison, and I'm fighting for second chances. I'm fighting for rehabilitation. And so yes, I could understand in some ways where people were coming from, or I had a superficial understanding, but I wanted to write the book because I wanted to go deeper. I wanted to tell the historical story from the 1960s and 1970s, because you said it was the 1970s, but I was practicing in the 1990s, so I didn't know all the history back into the 1970s. You know, until I started writing the book, I didn't know the history of heroin addiction in D.C. and other black communities in the 1960s. I didn't know that Jackie Robinson's son was a heroin addict, and that Jackie Robinson went around to black communities in the early 1970s and said, don't support marijuana decriminalization because marijuana will lead to heroin. And my son was a heroin addict and he started with marijuana. You know, I didn't know those stories. I didn't know Maxine Waters supported tougher penalties in the late 1970s. I didn't know any of that until I started doing the research.
And I'm sure at the time it seemed like the right thing to do. Surely in D.C. you drove through decimated communities, communities that were literally under siege by violent crime. So when you got into a courtroom and you had a client that you were defending as a public defender, did you truly have an expectation that the judge would somehow, because he was African-American, issue a different sentence simply by virtue of the fact that he happened to be African-American too?
It wasn't that I thought that they would issue a different sentence, no, but I guess I thought that there would be maybe some understanding for the social context in which decisions were being made. So, you know, one of the young men that I write about, you know, a kid named Brandon, he was a teenager charged with, he pled guilty to possession of a gun and possession of marijuana. And I was asking, in that case, I was asking for probation. And Brandon grew up in a really tough neighborhood, and a lot of kids in his neighborhood picked up guns. Sometimes they possessed guns. Sometimes it was self-protection. And I thought that the judge in that case would understand, okay, it's his first offense. His mother and his grandmother are there in court. He has no prior record. There was no crime, you know, violent crime that he committed. He just possessed it. And it wasn't that I thought, oh, you know, African-American judge is going to give a different sentence because he has an African-American defendant in front of him. But I thought that the judge coming out of that community maybe would understand some of the difficult conditions that Brandon was living under that helped cause him to pick up that gun.
And instead, you say the judge gave him what you call the Martin Luther King speech.
That's right. He said, you know, after I made my whole presentation, Judge Walker looked at Brandon and he said, you know, Mr. Forman has been telling me that you've had a tough life, but let me tell you about tough for real. Let me tell you about Jim Crow. And he told him about those years. And then he said, so here's the thing. People fought, marched, and died for your freedom. Dr. King died for your freedom. And he didn't die for you to be running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and embarrassing your family and embarrassing your community. He got going. I thought like it was like a church moment, you know. And then he wrapped up and he said, so I hope you turn your life around. But right now, actions have consequences. And your consequence is Oak Hill, which was the juvenile prison in D.C. And I knew how terrible of a place that was. You know, I knew that it, and the judge knew that it was a violent place. There was no school. There were no drug treatment programs, no mental health programs. Everybody in the city knew that somebody like Brandon was only going to get worse if they were locked up there. So again, I didn't expect the judge to do something different necessarily because he's African American, but I did expect him, maybe this is the way to put it. When I walked into a place like Oak Hill and I saw 150 young black boys under living in intolerable conditions, I was appalled as a matter of racial justice. And I felt like the judge should be too. I felt like he should look at that reality and say, I can't contribute to it, not today.
Around kitchen tables, around the country, I'm sure you know, James, that this conversation happens mm-hmm. in African-American communities from Bedford-Stuyvesant to East Oakland and all across the country. This conversation about what do we do about the violence in our communities, because people have a right to live without being afraid and not having to sleep in their bathtubs for fear of flying bullets. People are frightened and they're fed up and they're looking for answers. And in many ways, I'm sure you've had to answer to the charge that you come off as an apologist, that you're soft on crime, that this is at least part of the answer, if not the entire answer, that crime deserves punishment. So your answer is what?
Well, my answer is how much punishment, how much prison, for how long, under what conditions, right? So I'm not somebody who says nobody should ever be locked up. But I am somebody who believes that prison should be reserved for the small percentage of the population, in my view, small percentage of our current prison population that truly right now is a threat to society. And that while people are incarcerated, that we should provide them education. We should provide them job training. The majority of people who are in prison today have addiction issues and mental health issues. And I believe that for their benefit, as a matter of morality and humanity, what we owe to our fellow brothers and sisters, men and women, citizens, as well as a matter of self-interest, because most people are coming out and we want them to come out more healed, less damaged than they came in. I believe that we should provide, even for those who are incarcerated, those kinds of conditions. And right now, if you walk into a prison in America, you don't see any of that. You rarely see a functioning classroom. And so, yeah, for me, it's some people are going to be locked up, but I believe many, many fewer, 10 or 20% of our current prison population, I would say, deserves to be locked up. And for those people, we need to treat them differently.
Well, it appears this was something of an experiment. So if you would just take us back to the 60s and 70s, when this experiment in punitive criminal justice and what you call felon disenfranchisement began.
Right. So you're right. The United States prison population has mostly was stable for out our history. And it's always been higher than, for example, European countries, but only somewhat higher. And then starting in the early 1970s is when, as you said in your introduction, when that 200,000 number really starts to increase. And by the 80s and 90s is when it goes off the charts. And the reasons for that, right, the sources for that are complicated. But one of what I add to the story in my book is looking at this through the lens of African-American communities. So in the 1960s, we did have this heroin addict. In a city like D.C., the homicide rate tripled in the 60s. Nationally, the homicide rate doubled. Oakland, it more than doubled. Heroin tore through black communities nationwide. We had in D.C., in 1963, 3% of the people entering the D.C. jail were considered addicts. By 1969, that 3% had become 45%. So you have addiction rising, you have homicide doubling and tripling, and then you get this first generation of African-American elected officials. People, I mean, at the mayors, we know people like Carl Stokes and Maynard Jackson and Tom Bradley and Marion Barry in Washington, D.C., Walter Washington in Washington, D.C. But they're also, they have counterparts in city councils and they have counterparts in police departments. We have an 800% increase in black elected officials in the 1970s. So right after this crime rise, you get this first generation of black elected officials and police officers coming into power, and they're desperate to do something about it. As you said, they come out of a history where people didn't pay attention to crime in the black, you know, in the 1940s, 1950s, you didn't call the police in black neighborhoods if there was a crime because they weren't going to come. And if they did, they were just going to make matters worse, right? So they know that history. And now that they're empowered to run municipal governments, they want to make those governments respond to the claims of black citizens for protection. So they say, we got to do something about this crime. And one of the things is police and prisons. And as you also pointed out, they wanted other things. They didn't only want police and prisons. They wanted jobs. They wanted education. They wanted housing. But they didn't get those things. We got police, prosecutors, and prisons.
And fast forward to today when the Sentencing Project poll shows that 64% of African Americans believe that sentencings aren't harsh enough out of that kind of desperation. So it's an interesting phenomenon, and we're hoping that those of you just joining us will give us a call. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org, and feedback at yourcallradio.org is available too. But give us a call. James Forman is here. He is the author of Locking Up Our Own. Our phone lines are open at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Have you been a victim of crime in your community? Did you attend the trial? What were your thoughts about how crime was treated in your case? Are you in law enforcement? And what do you think of how law enforcement is being carried out? Is it disproportionate in African-American communities? We invite your participation. 866-798-8255. You know, I'm wondering, James, what you think the role of class is in this. You know, there was a case, I think it was just last week in Florida, where an African-American woman was stopped by a police officer and she was asked for her license and registration. Mm-hmm. She produced it and, of course, wanted to know why she was stopped. And little did the officer know, she was, an assistant attorney general in the state. Yeah. And he said that it was because her windows were dark and that they routinely ran license plates. But there was real outrage. You could see it. There was video from his body cam. And you could see that she was outraged that she had been stopped. And so it's because no doubt she'd never been stopped before. But there were probably other African Americans who lived in that very neighborhood who could tell her about multiple stops. So what role does class play in the meeting out of justice?
Well, I think it plays a big role across the board in America, including in black communities. So the class issue isn't one that's limited to the black community, because if you go, you know, if you look at among white population or other populations that are locked up, overwhelmingly it's poor folks. But to focus on the issue within the black community, first and foremost, you know, I talked about that scenario with the judge, and I'm arguing for Brandon to be released, and there's the African-American prosecutor arguing for him to be locked up, and the judge ultimately locks him up. And one way, you know, when the title of my book is Locking Up Our Own, and the idea is that all of us have something in common, right? Everyone in that courtroom, because we were all African-American, Brandon, me, the judge, the prosecutor. But there's another way your class question kind of pushes at that and says, well, maybe we weren't all our. Maybe, and maybe from Brandon's perspective, he looked at that courtroom and what he saw was he saw two lawyers and a judge, and we were of a different class background, either by how we were raised or even if, because a lot of folks, right, they were raised poor, but now they're professionals. He, from Brandon's perspective, he might say, who's us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a class divide in this courtroom. And that's real, you know, and we don't talk about that enough. If you look at the numbers, so if you're an African-American man who's dropped out of high school, you are 10 times more likely to go to prison in your lifetime than an African-American man who's gone to college. We don't have the data for women, but everything suggests it would be a similar gap. So in our community, when we talk about mass incarceration in the black community, it is something that affects us all, but we also have to be real. It's something that affects the poorest, most isolated parts of our community by far the worst. And so part of my book is a plea to the black middle class. of which I'm a part, to recognize and own this issue and own our responsibility, own the role that we have played, own the ways in which our safety, our own safety, has been bought through some of these harsh practices.
Well, you do talk about leaders like Maxine Waters, like Eric Holder. There are, in your book, examples of Jet Magazine and Ebony Magazine articles where the African-American community is calling for stricter policing. So I'm wondering if there's an initiative that you can point to that started out with good intentions to address the problem but sort of ended up actually hurting the black community. Is there a particular policy that was a turning point?
Well, to me, there's a few examples of that in the book, but one of them, I think, that really gets at this idea of it started out with good intentions but had these negative effects is a program in D.C. It was called Operation Ceasefire, although you see it nationally under different names. And it's this idea of pretext stops or investigatory policing. So, you know, most people know about stop and frisk, right? This idea that, well, we're going to stop you, we're going to search you, and we're going to try to get weapons or drugs. But pretext stops and investigatory stops are the car version of that. So it was really what was happening with what you described, the African-American prosecutor who was stopped. Mm-hmm. That was a pretext stop. Mm-hmm. He was running her. That tinted window story, in fact, the tinted window story that he gave is exactly the same story that the police gave in a example that I give in the book. So the idea of investigatory stops is we're going to pull you over for whatever reason we can come up with, not because we're really trying to enforce the traffic laws, but because we want to get in the car, because we want to see if you've got any drugs or guns in the car. And this idea was Eric Holder supported it, led it really in Washington, D.C., and it was in response to the violence of the crack years. And so again, you say good intentions, right? Violence was much too high. And Eric Holder is somebody who cares deeply about the black community and, in my opinion, always has. And he thought that the way to protect it, the way to get the guns off the street, was through these investigatory stops. But here's the thing. Once the police start down that path, in addition to the guns, and they get some guns, they do, but they get a lot of other stuff as well. So one of the stories that I tell is a client of mine named Sandra Dozier. She's driving home. She's got her daughter in the car. And she's pulled over by the police for the allegation is tinted windows. They didn't care about the tinted windows. That was just something that they did to pull her over. Then they ask her to search, if they can search. Most people, over 95% of the people, consent. You're allowed to say no, but most people consent. They searched. They found marijuana.
I remember she's the FedEx employee who was on probation, and because of this stop, even though she was a great employee, she wasn't able to keep her job because of this.
Exactly.
That was a heartbreaking story, but I have a hunch it's not altogether uncommon that people literally have their lives upended because of that kind of policing, yes?
That's right. And we talk about, you know, if you look at that case one way, well, she had marijuana. I mean, it was a small amount, $15, $20 worth. So, you know, you could say, well, she had the drugs. What's she complaining about? How can she complain? Okay, fine, she lost her job, but she had the drugs. She shouldn't have the drugs. But the unfairness comes from the fact that if she hadn't been black and she hadn't lived in that high crime community, she never would have been stopped. So my kids that I teach at Yale, or this year I've been teaching out at Stanford, or kids that I went to college with at Brown, you know, white kids, kids with means in D.C. and elsewhere, they go unimpeded. So their marijuana never gets found because they're not getting stopped on this nonsense. They're not, the police aren't asking them for consent to search. And so they're not getting arrested for possession of marijuana. So it's just a good example to me of how an unfair practice that had understandable roots, gun violence, leads to mass unfairness, mass disenfranchisement, mass job loss for all of the Sandra Doziers of the world.
We're going to talk disparity and how the law may or may not be equally applied with James Forman Jr. He's the author of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America, a very provocative look at some of the perhaps misguided ways that African-American leaders called for increased police presence and mass incarceration. And what is your thought on that? We hope you'll give us a call. We'll be right back.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. You can call us by telephone, you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can go to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call us toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org, and there you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. If you have a show idea for us, drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. Coming up on Thursday's show, what happened to California's single-payer health care bill? That $400 billion plan to rebuild the state's health care system has fallen by the wayside after passing the Senate. So what happens next for California and its fight to win universal health care? We hope you'll be here for Rose Aguilar with Your Call. That's at 10 a.m. with Rose Aguilar and you. You can join our conversation today with James Forman Jr., who's written a very, very provocative book. It's called Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. What do you do when your community is under siege by violence? For decades, the answer was more policing and more incarceration, but it may have had the unintended consequence of locking up African Americans at a tremendous rate and a disparity in how that kind of incarceration is even being meted out by judges. Let's go to your calls. Let's start with Irwin in San Francisco. Hi, Irwin. Thanks for waiting.
Okay, the name's Irving, but it doesn't matter. Back in Quincy, Mass, in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a program called Payback. It was through the courts. And what would happen is when the concept was that kids learn to be criminals in reform school, and then locking them up just made them more criminals. And the program dealt with getting them jobs through the courts where they would pay back for any damage they did. And the program was pretty effective. I can't remember the name of the guy who pushed it at the University of Massachusetts, but I do remember the judge that started it in Quincy. His name was Al Kramer, and he's probably dead now, but he and I were good buddies, and I worked in the program for a year in Pittsfield. It was pretty successful. We got kids jobs like bicycle repair, leather working, and that kind of thing, and I think one of the problems is that we have this concept of what that was made clear on the program, this concept of punishment rather than rehabilitation. And I'm at the same time I'm talking to you, I'm looking through my library, telling,
okay, Irving,
trying to get the names of the people involved.
Yes. I wanted to talk about restitution, as a matter of fact. Thanks for your call, Irving. Restitution, rehabilitation, and now there's a sort of a U-turn. The new administration, rather than the kinds of programs that Irving was talking about that started in the 60s, perhaps, now it's about civil asset forfeiture. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, before I get into that, I just want to mention to Irving and anybody else who's listening that I'm going to be speaking tonight at Book Passage at the Ferry Building at 6 p.m. And so if anybody wants to come out and to continue the conversation, I would love that. But in terms of asset forfeiture, that's something that was the idea there is we're not just going to arrest you if you are selling drugs or in possession of drugs, but we're also going to take your assets, right? We're going to take your property. And the theory is, well, we have to take the profit motivation out of drug dealing. And this was a very, very popular concept in the 1980s. So you have somebody like Marion Barry. I quote him in my book. He says, "I'm for confiscating cars, houses, jewelry, television sets." And he goes on, he says, "This may sound rather harsh, but if a drug dealer buys his mother a bedroom suite or some luggage, I'm for taking the luggage and the bedroom suite at the same time." So this kind of rhetoric, right, that we're going to take all your stuff is what Jeff Sessions is now trying to bring us back to. The problem with asset forfeiture is that it's been abused. The problem is that it gives local police an incentive to make as many drug stops as they can, because under the federal law and under some state laws, they can seize the assets from the drug seizure, and then they can use a percentage of those profits to fund their local law enforcement operations. So as you can see, you know, if you're a struggling municipality, right, and our local governments don't have enough money, this encourages you to focus on drug seizures when really you should be focusing your attention on violent crime, right? You should be focusing your attention on murders, on robberies. One of the things that's so unfair about our criminal justice system is that we have police everywhere on the one hand, but it's still the case, especially if you're poor, if you call the police because of a crime, there's long delay in getting an answer. And so that's the problem with asset forfeiture, is it gives police an incentive to focus on the wrong things.
Again, everything old is new again. It was tried back in Marion Barry's day. And now, just yesterday, Jeff Sessions says, "I've got an idea. Let's forfeit assets." All right. Let's go to Jackie in San Francisco. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning. Thank you for your program. It is an honor to hear Mr. Foreman. It is an honor that he has written about the truth. For over 50 years, I have often been concerned that many African Americans seem not to be cognizant of the philosophical fact that those who are oppressed take on characteristics of the oppressor. Thank you very much, and I wish everybody a wonderful day.
Thank you, Jackie. Do you want to comment on that sentiment?
No, except to say thank you. And, you know, I'll say one thing, which is that when we talk about African Americans, sometimes we are using that in distinction to other Americans, right? In distinction to the larger society, in distinction to white Americans or other ethnic groups. But the thing to know about African Americans is that we are Americans, right? And that means we can consume the same media, right? We share a similar history in many ways. And so this idea, right, and I think this is what Jack is getting at, that there's a culture that we have towards harshness in our criminal system. The idea that when we come into positions of power and authority as African Americans, we will in some ways kind of inhabit that same stance. You know, I think she's exactly right. And a lot of the book is about that.
All right. Let's go to Laura in Alameda. Hi, Laura.
So on the follow-up of the last caller, one of the things I've noticed as a substitute teacher is from time to time when I ask for help from the local people at the school, often what happens, and this often happens more with the adult African-American men, is they assume that it's the African-American male children who are the problem, which is not necessarily the case. And I was shocked earlier this year that happened, and I finally had the courage to address it. But I find it interesting that it shows up in a greater, and it's just to follow on the last speakers. And I, you know, as a person who's white, I'm not quite sure how to address it. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
I think the way to address it is that we have to focus on the implicit biases that we all have. So there's a lot of research, and she's caller is talking about how teachers react to students misbehaving. And there's a lot of research, whether you look at teachers and students or police officers and citizens, that says that we as Americans, all of us, and to a somewhat lesser extent, this is true of African Americans, but it's still true that we have built-in biases and prejudices, so we're more likely to see the same conduct as being violent or criminal when it's a black person doing it than when it's a white person. In the school context, same story. And so the only way I think to respond to that is to recognize it, to own it, to say, listen, we all live in a country with a history of racism and slavery, a country that has told itself lies. Like, think about the lies that you have to tell yourself as a country to justify slavery.
But there are parts of America that are looking at the news and they say, what I see are crime rates that are higher in African American communities. Isn't it possible that the reason that there are more African Americans in prison is because they disproportionately are involved in crime? And what about black-on-black crime? How is it that you seem to be able to justify being lenient, if you will, on a criminal when they are victimizing their own communities? Those are sentiments that are out there. Your response to that is what?
Well, there's a lot there.
There's a lot there in that question.
But so let me just finish though about in terms of the caller's question, because what she's talking about, and I think it goes to your question as well, is the same conduct, right? There's research that shows they'll do videos and they'll have a black child and a white child doing the same thing. And the studies show that teachers and also regular people that watch these videos are more likely to call the black child who's doing that thing unruly, more likely to call them a future criminal. And whereas with the white child who's doing it, they're more likely to say, well, they must have had a bad day, right? There's an explanation for that behavior that's something other than who they are. And that We all suffer that. So when you say the other thing I guess I want to focus on when you talk about the differential crime rates. So, yes, it's true. For certain offenses, no question about it. Robbery is a good example. Homicide is a good example. We have pretty good research from lots of sources that say that African-Americans commit those at rates disproportionate to our rate in the overall population. However, there are some other things that are true as well. For drug crimes, which have produced a lot of mass, a significant portion, even if a minority of mass incarceration, that isn't true. Like drug offenses, drug possession, drug use is equally distributed across American society, and yet black people are more likely to go to prison for it. And there's another point as well, which is if you look at an individual African American person, yes, it's true that blacks are disproportionately, are more likely to be incarcerated. But an individual black person is overwhelmingly not likely to be a criminal. So in other words, so it depends on what's the question we're asking. So if we look at a black man standing on the corner, my point that I want to make to the callers and in response to your question is that the overwhelming majority of black men are not committing crime. And so the fact that we commit crime at a higher rate than some other group really isn't a relevant question. The question is that person that you're looking at, if you're a police officer driving by and I know that person is black, can I assume that that person is committing a crime? And the answer to that statistically is no.
Okay. Individualizing, in other words, making sure that you're looking at an individual as opposed to any preconceived notions about the group to which he belongs.
Thank you.
Got it. All right, let's go to George in San Francisco. Thanks for holding, George.
Thank you. Mr. Foreman, a question which we do have for you is, in your description of a client who thought, oh, nothing's lost if I just say, okay, you can examine my car, what would happen if she had said no? You said she has the right to say no, you can't examine my car, but how does a person properly negotiate that stance, and what's the likely outcome?
Well, that's a great question. So legally, she had the right to say, no, you cannot search. However, and that's what I encourage people to do. I think that we should not consent to searches that we have the right not to consent to. At the same time, there's a lot of power dynamics at play in that instance. And what my client and many of my clients are fearful of is that their refusal to consent is not going to be honored by the police officer.
Is there a racial component to that fear?
Yes. The studies that we have show in terms of who gets stopped and who, and there's a racial disparity in who police ask to search the car. Mm-hmm. We don't have great data on when someone refuses consent, how the police respond, how often do police ignore that. The data there is anecdotal. There aren't not rigorous studies on it. But there's lots of anecdotes of people saying, I said no, and they did it anyway. And so that's a hard question, and that's a hard moment. But if you do refuse consent, and if the police ignore that, they've acted unlawfully. And you should contact the local ACLU in Northern California. There's a very robust chapter of the ACLU of Northern California, and ask them to look at your case.
All right, let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hello. Are you talking to me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, it's Harvey, not Harry.
Oh, sorry. Go right ahead, Harvey.
Yeah. So anyway, I was telling you, in the early 90s, I was visiting a friend of mine who was awaiting trial in Santa Rita. That's the county jail for Alameda County near Pleasanton. And after I left, I drove out the parking lot about a quarter or a half mile. I was pulled over by a Alameda County sheriff's person who ran my license and checked if I had any warrants. He said the reason was because I drove out of the parking lot using the wrong exit. There was an arrow pointing into the parking lot, and I drove out, contrary to the arrow. So he pretty much said it was just so they could run warrant checks on people who were visiting the prison there. So
it seems relevant. If I can I ask you what your nationality is?
Oh, I'm white.
Okay. So
black people will do it, it was really nice and courteous, but just. They just did it as an excuse so they could run a warrant check. Yeah.
So what he's saying is that this happens routinely, and that perhaps African Americans shouldn't be sensitive to the fact that this is part of routine policing, particularly maybe in high crime areas.
Well, I guess I have two thoughts. So I don't know, of course, the particulars of his situation and what the law enforcement justification was, or was not in that moment. But I think that we have to, when we start to think about how some of our kind of disparate or unfair or brutal police practices affect white Americans as well, or kind of dragnet style. To me, I would think of this as kind of a dragnet style policing. We're just going to ask everybody, you do randomly pull people over for warrant checks. That's that we live in a free country, and the presumption is that you should be free to move around, go where you want to go, including to visit a prison, without on your way out being stopped for a random warrant check. So to me, that's the fundamental proposition that all Americans have. That's a freedom that's guaranteed by our Constitution and by our legal system. Now, there's times where police overstep that. And in terms of the racial disparities, I guess I want us to hold two things in our head at the same time. First of all, something like the war on drugs or over-aggressive policing or militarized policing disproportionately affects African Americans, right? It's especially bad for black people. At the same time, it affects everybody, right? That is to say, white people are harmed by it too. Asians are harmed by it too. Latinos are harmed by it too. Native Americans are harmed by it too. African Americans are especially harmed, and poor African Americans especially. But everybody's harmed by a mentality that says, we're going to pull you over willy-nilly just to do warrant checks.
Let's talk, too, about guns. Gun control. And you go into a great deal of the history that gun control was not something that Americans even thought about much. Everybody had a musket during the Revolutionary period, and only after Reconstruction, when African Americans were freed and started getting guns, did it turn out to be an issue. And then it kind of reverberated again in the 60s when, for example, the Black Panthers went into the California legislature, and all of a sudden, at the then time, Ronald Reagan, the governor, said all of a sudden gun control was important. So just talk about how guns and the prevalence of them perhaps in African-American communities has led to more arrests and stiffer sentences.
Well, one of the things that I think is really important about this, because we're in a moment right now, actually just this month, both in Baltimore and in Chicago, there have been pushes that many African-American legislators have supported. Some have opposed, but some have supported for mandatory minimums for certain gun offenses, gun possession offenses in Baltimore. And I think that's a mistake. I think mandatory minimum sentences are a mistake across the board. They shift discretion to prosecutors. They deny individualized justice. They lead to longer sentences. And we've come to understand that in the context of drug laws. But I think it's true about gun laws as well. And one of the things I write about in the book, the second chapter of the book is called Black Lives Matter. And it's the story of how gun control became popular in Black communities in the 1970s. And it was a response to, I mentioned before, the homicide rate doubling and tripling in Black communities nationwide. So people are scared, right? People are frightened. People see violence taking a toll that we've never seen before in American communities. And they want action. They want to do something. And mandatory minimums for gun offenses, they seem like such an appealing answer, right? It's like, yeah, do the crime, do the time. It's guaranteed, can't be negotiated. But we see what happens with that over time, which is we have the same disparities. If you look at a city like D.C. where I practiced, we know about the disparities in the drug prosecutions, but overwhelmingly, we see those same disparities in the gun prosecutions as well. So one of the calls that I make in the book is for us in the Black community and those people who care about racial justice to not be so quick to turn to prison as a response to gun crime or gun possession.
All right. Let's go to another call. Paul in Oakland. Welcome, Paul.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And Mr. Foreman, thanks for the book. I just wanted to offer a couple of quick comments. One, there was a DOJ conference in 2010 that talked about large rates of discipline for elementary school kids, and they even ran down into primary school preschool for four-year-old Black boys. That was one thing I wanted to comment on. The other piece is one of the things we're missing in this discussion. I mean, in your practice, right, you see the end results of some systemic issues that we as a community need to take on and address around economics and education, and not in terms of platitudes, but like some of this is real work, and there are systemic things oppressing progress of this, but there is also stuff that we can do. The other piece along that line as well is people should not be surprised about being biased within their own community. I mean, all you have to do is take the implicit association test. I'm a Black man. Mm. When I took the test for Black males, I have some bias towards my own people, and that falls for women who take the test for women or people in the LGBTQ community. So that shouldn't be surprising to us. And I hear you. We do need to get at that. And then the final thing I'd offer is, especially at the policy level, we shouldn't be surprised because this is not just a singular characteristic of Black communities. Rashid Khalidi wrote a book called The Iron Triangle, which talked about how Palestinians, and I bring that just because they're far away in another place, how they do policy which does not help their cause, right? Because they don't, because of the way the system's giving them constraints, right? And all this to say, we do need to smarten up. And I'm with you. I volunteer at a local school here in Oakland, and I can see the narratives written in second grade that lead to where they're going to land up in your courts and your law offices. And that's heartbreaking, and we don't get it. I mean, throwing them away with it, do the crime, do the time mentality, it's not servicing us so well. And like you said, it's not servicing the rest of the community either. And those are my comments.
Thanks, Paul.
No, thank you for that, Paul. And you mentioned being from Oakland. I just want to throw out there that on August 13th, I'm going to be in Oakland. I'm going to be speaking at Marcus Bookstore, which is the oldest continually operated African-American bookstore in the country. So I'll be there on August 13th from 2 to 4 p.m. and going to be having a really good conversation about this. I hope you can come out. And I agree with all your points. Thank you for making them.
You know, I wonder if you've ever been a victim of crime. Have you? Violent crime?
I have not been a victim of violent crime. I've been a victim of property crime only.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been stopped by the police and wondered if it was because of your race?
A couple times. You know, I'm mixed race. My dad's African American. My mom is white. I'm pretty light skinned. And I've found that I get my race will often be read in conjunction with who I'm with because of. So if I'm with a group of African-American friends, black friends, I'm more likely to be read as black and, you know, vice versa. But I grew up in Atlanta and I was stopped by the police in Atlanta with a group of friends when I was in high school. And we didn't know. You know, that's one of the things sometimes you don't really know. What was the basis for it? Was this legitimate, or were we being stopped simply because we were four young African American boys? So I don't know.
Well, let's look forward, shall we? President Obama in 2015 introduced sentencing reform. Is that going anywhere, or have we done a U-turn under the Trump administration?
Well, at the federal level, I think we've done a U-turn. So. You know, President Trump and really most importantly, Jeff Sessions have made this U-turn. But at the local level, there's still a lot of progressive initiatives going forward. And so people that care about this issue, we're going to have to focus locally.
I want to say thank you so much to James Forman Jr. He's a law scholar, Yale University professor, and author of the book Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. Very interesting conversation. Looking forward to it. I've been looking forward to it for weeks, so thank you so much. He's going to be reading tonight at Book Passage at the Ferry Building in San Francisco. That's at 6 o'clock. This is Your Call. It's produced at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for the podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Sanaa Saleem produced today's show. Phil Hartman is chief engineer. Kevin Vance is the studio engineer. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks to all the callers, and sorry we couldn't get to everyone. We appreciate all of your input. I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call.